Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from London, I'm Ragini Vaidyanathan. As feverish diplomacy continues to try and end the war in Ukraine, a reminder, the conflict goes on. As he headed back to the country after a tumultuous few days of meetings in the US and the UK, President Zelensky said that Russia had launched more than 1,000 attack drones, almost 1,300 bombs and more than 20 missiles into his country over the last week. President Zelensky said the world needed to be more united and stronger to make Russia stop the strikes.
You're gambling with World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country.
But there are major cracks in that unity after that very public row between President Trump and Vice President Vance and Mr. Zelensky on Friday.
What's your message to US President? Can a deal be signed?
On Sunday, Mr. Zelensky got a warmer reception here in London as he attended a conference convened by the British Prime Minister to try and find a path to peace. Keir Starmer said that European leaders had agreed to boost military aid to Kyiv so that it could negotiate any settlement from a position of strength.
First, we will keep the military aid flowing and keep increasing the economic pressure on Russia to strengthen Ukraine now. Second, we agreed that any lasting peace must ensure Ukraine's sovereignty and security, and Ukraine must be at the table. Third, in the event of a peace deal, we will keep boosting Ukraine's own defensive capabilities to deter any future invasion. Fourth, we will go further to develop a coalition of the willing to defend a deal in Ukraine and to guarantee the peace.
But how do leaders get to a guarantee of peace? Well, French President Emmanuel Macron has suggested a partial one-month ceasefire in Ukraine. Speaking to Le Figaro newspaper, he suggested a truce in the air, on the seas and on energy infrastructure. Reports suggest it's a deal backed by Britain too, but the UK Armed Forces Minister told the BBC that there are a number of options, but none have been agreed. Well, Eleanor Carroir is the deputy of the French National Assembly from Mr. Macron's Renaissance Party. So, what does Europe do next?
We've been lending money, we've been granting money, and we've been producing, we've been forming Ukrainian soldiers. But right now, we need to do more and in a unified fashion. And that means more military spending for some European countries, coordinated aid, and ensuring Ukraine is at the table of negotiation.
And you've also talked about a ceasefire plan, a temporary ceasefire plan. Just tell us about that.
It would be a one-month-long truce applying only to air, sea, energy installations. And if that is respected and if the discussions move forward properly, then after that, there would be a total ceasefire and a real discussion for a strong and lasting peace.
Are there some differences and disagreements, though, between France and the UK on what that ceasefire plan might look like? Because we've heard from the UK Armed Forces Minister this morning saying on the BBC that the plan wasn't a plan that they currently recognise. He said there's a number of options being discussed, but none have been agreed. So what are the sticking points?
This is a blueprint, right? It's a draft and several ideas. Apparently, they were discussed, but is not to say that it's going to be enforced tomorrow. But I think the general idea that we all need to have in mind is that it is impossible to have a ceasefire or a peace deal that does not imply Ukraine. And the other very important aspect of it is that Russia attacked Ukraine. And this may sound basic to us Europeans, but apparently it's under question. And I think these are at least common grounds upon which it is possible to build a peace solution that would be lasting and not just a ceasefire that could potentially not be respected in a couple of weeks or months by Russia.
Of course, so, Eleanor, there are many other sticking points. Another one that the Armed Forces Minister talked about today was all of these plans depending on that critical US backstop, which, again, we don't know is going to come. Tell us about your thoughts on that and more broadly, where you see the relationship with the US at the moment.
Russia is forcing us into breaking the relationship with the US, and the US has been our strongest and longest ally. And we have been aligned on the support to Ukraine. The arrival of Donald Trump and his administration, there has been a shift on the words, on the style, on the diplomacy. But this does not mean that there is a breakup with the US. There shouldn't be one. We Europeans need to be prepared to defend ourselves. But this being said, we need to ensure the US stays involved. They're sending mixed messages, but they haven't said that they want out, at least not at this stage.
Is there a scenario where the US doesn't actually play a big role? I mean, we've heard from a former Ukrainian MP saying that Europe's looking for a way of calming the conflict between Presidents Trump and Zelensky, but he says the Europeans are not ready to replace the US. Is he right?
The Europeans increase their military capacity, but not every country has done it the same way. In France, we voted a massive military plan, and we're now spending more of our GDP.
France is hovering around 2%, and the US wants it to get to 5% of GDP.
They can say and come up with figures. I think they're spending 3% of their own GDP, 3.8%. What matters is not what France alone can do, is what we do again as Europeans. At least in France, we produce our own military planes, and we've been selling them throughout Europe. I think right now there is an awakening. It's a difficult one, granted, but we all know that we're not strong alone. We're only strong if we're together.
And of course, the other question to ask as well is how you get Russia on board to any of your ceasefire plans.
Russia is playing a very dangerous game right now. If they are indeed willing to reach peace, we need leverage. And part of that leverage could come from their frozen assets that would allow us to continue financing Ukraine. Part of it could also be increasing Ukraine's military production. There's sanctions, obviously. We also need to make strong and difficult decisions with regards to the purchase of Russian gas. And we do have leverage. And that's an important message. And I think both the US and Russia understand it. Now, the idea is not to create a breakup again with the US, but to work together, ensuring Ukraine is at the table.
That's the French MP, Eleanor Calroix, speaking to us from Paris. So the view from France there, but now let's turn to Ukraine. Well, President Zelensky goes back home without the minerals deal he'd hoped to sign with the US. Instead, he's carrying the baggage of a fractured relationship with America and greater uncertainty on how war in his country ends. After attending Sunday's meeting in London, he had this to say on ties with the US.
Я думаю, що наші відносини будуть продовжені, тому що це більше ніж.
I think our relations with the US will continue because this is more than relations during a certain moment. We must be transparent. Ukraine is not the biggest country in the world, but everyone can see how it fights for its independence and freedom. We count on assistance from the United States of America without a doubt. I think stopping such assistance will only help Putin. And because of that, I think that the United States and representatives of the civilized world, leaders of this world, definitely won't help Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Ivana Klimpush-Tsinzadze is a Ukrainian MP and chair of the Parliamentary Committee on Ukraine's integration into the EU. I asked her what comes next after the few days we've seen.
I think the situation is very difficult and pretty critical. There are a couple of things that have to be done, first of all, at home in terms of ensuring the internal cohesion and maximum use of all of our resources. Secondly, it's the coordination and cooperation with all the European partners and beyond in terms of making sure that they are ready to upscale their support to Ukraine, and then also coordinating in this vision for the ceasefire and potential peace with inclusion of the security provisions for Ukraine. And also, I think the critical thing continues to be to ensure that we are engaging with the US authorities and that we do all together have America on the right side of the history and have access to their military capacities, possibilities, and also the strength that was declared as peace through strength.
That's a challenge at the moment, though, isn't it, Ivana, when you hear President Trump saying after that exchange on Friday in the White House that he believes that President Zelensky's not ready for peace?
I think we should not be engaging in this heated, emotional public exchange. I think it's about finding the people, finding the ways to get to reestablish the dialogue with the American administration on different levels and not necessarily exclusively of the levels of the presidents. This is about, you know, calling a spade and making sure that everybody understands why this war is ongoing and that it's definitely not Ukraine that doesn't want peace. But I think that we have to think maybe of specific additional envoys that would be acceptable for the US administration.
But what we heard from some other senior officials was a similar refrain as we heard from President Trump, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, saying that Mr. Zelensky was Ukraine-splaining. We heard from Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, in fact, essentially suggesting that maybe President Zelensky needs to go. He said, we need a leader that can deal with us, eventually deal with the Russians and end this war. There are other US politicians also suggesting that maybe it's a time for a change of president. What would you say to that?
We cannot hold any elections during the wartime and during the martial law, and the organizational security conditions do not allow for us to have this.
But what if that was a condition for peace, that there was a ceasefire agreed, but perhaps one of the conditions might be that President Zelensky has to step aside?
Are we looking for real elections, or are we looking for something that is called elections like they are in the Russian Federation, but have nothing to do with free and fair elections?
And what's the mood amongst the Ukrainian people after this very roller coaster weekend or week, you know, few days that we've seen in terms of international diplomacy?
Ukrainian people are actually getting united once again, or reunited once again. But also I'm worried that there is a growing anti-American sentiment in the Ukrainian society. And that is something that I'd love to preclude from happening.
If you get to speak to President Zelensky in the coming days, what will you be saying to him?
That he shouldn't rely exclusively on himself and a couple of managers that are around him. He should tap into the intellectual and professional potential of many political teams that are in the country. I think that he's not using all the potential advice that he could get, making sure that you get everybody on board trying to produce A, B, and C plans for Ukraine.
That was the Ukrainian MP Ivana Klimpush-Tsinzadze speaking to us from Kyiv. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. Coming up.
In 2014, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie published an essay of her popular TED Talk that was her take on feminism that was then sampled by Beyoncé.
Feminist, a person who believes in the social, political and economic equality of the sexes.
Where are we with feminism now, do you think?
We should say that there is no place in the world where women are equal. There are places that are better and places that are worse, but there is just gender equality does not exist yet.
And you can hear Emma Barnett's interview with the Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie in 30 minutes. But first, a reminder of our top headline this hour. Police in the German city of Mannheim say at least one person has died after a car drove into a crowd of people. This is Regini Vaidyanathan with NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC in London. So earlier we were talking about the differing positions when it comes to finding a path to peace for Ukraine. Well, now let's take a look at what Russia's view is on all of this. President Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov has been reacting to that Ukraine meeting which took place in London this weekend. Speaking to reporters by phone, he said no coordinated peace plan was on the agenda yet.
We see that the collective West has partially begun to lose its collectivity. A sort of fragmentation of the collective West has begun. The formation of nuanced positions by a number of countries and groups of countries. There remains a group of countries which rather constitutes the party of war, which declares that it is ready to further support Ukraine in terms of supporting the war.
Well, our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, joins us from Moscow. Always good to have you on NewsHour, Steve. There's lots to talk about, isn't there, after the last few days. But what's the diplomatic view at the moment from Russia when it looks at what happened on Friday in the White House and also what happened here in London over the weekend?
The Russians have been very dismissive of the London summit. I think they believe that whatever peace plan France and the UK and Ukraine come up with, it won't get through Donald Trump. I think the Russians believe that Moscow is building a new relationship with Washington, with the Trump administration, and that Donald Trump would prefer to get on with building this relationship with Russia rather than standing by Ukraine. And, you know, when you read the Russian newspapers here, they are celebratory. I mean, today there was one newspaper which quoted a Russian MP saying the Western system is collapsing like a house of cards. There was a professor quoted in another Russian paper saying we can barely conceal the gloating. There is this, this atmosphere of celebration here that, you know, having lost the Cold War, more than 30 years on, Russia feels that it's turning the tables on the West with this new relationship with America.
Does that mean in some ways Russia just needs to kind of sit back and watch what's happening?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we haven't heard yet from Vladimir Putin since Friday. We haven't heard directly from him what his view is of those traumatic scenes in the Oval Office. We haven't heard from him about the London summit. He doesn't need to say anything about that right now. He can sit back and just let events unfold, because right now they are unfolding to his benefit.
And Steve, you say, of course, right now they are unfolding. We saw that plan that France wants to come up with for a temporary ceasefire. Is that something that Russia might eventually engage in?
Well, I mean, based on what Russian officials have been saying in recent weeks, no, they're not interested in a temporary ceasefire. Vladimir Putin has said he wants a firm deal and a lasting peace. I think actually what Russia really wants is everything it asked for last year. When Vladimir Putin presented his so-called peace proposal in June of last year, which actually read more like a call for Ukraine's capitulation. He wants all the territory that he's seized so far in Ukraine, plus a little bit more that's not under Russian control. He wants Western sanctions to be scrapped, and he doesn't want Ukraine in NATO.
Okay, Steve Rosenberg, thank you very much for bringing us the take from Moscow. And you can see more from Steve on the BBC News website. TikTok's making profits from live streams selling sexual content in Kenya, with some involving teenagers as young as 15. The BBC's found some live videos where young women are selling sexual content services, with TikTok taking a 70% cut from gifts sent to them on the platform. Whistleblowers from the company which moderates TikTok say that the platform knows this is happening, but is failing to take adequate action, despite its own guidelines stating that the selling of sex is banned. Dabula Kamoli reports.
It's after midnight in Nairobi, and I'm on TikTok Live.
My number is on the bio, guys. Inbox me.
Inbox? Yes, come now.
In this one, young women are taking it in turns to dance provocatively. There's 450 people watching from around the world. And there's a host who's directing them and calling on people to send them money in the form of digital gifts.
Guys, please elevate Amazon. Elevate you dancer to Amazon.
There's a flurry of activity. Icons of roses, cowboy hats, money guns explode onto the screen. Payments are coming through.
Inbox for Kinembe, guys. Kinembe, inbox.
Thank you so much.
At the end of another live stream, the women say, inbox me for sexual content. I've come across many late-night live streams on TikTok like this, where young women are soliciting sex work. We're in a low-income neighborhood, one of the poorer neighborhoods in East London. And in places like this, there's that sense of urgency of trying to get money daily because people are not living off a salary, you know. People are hustling every day. We're meeting someone we're calling Esther. She's now 17, but says she was recruited to dance on TikTok Live 2 years ago when she was just 15.
I sell myself on TikTok. I dance naked, live. I do that because that's where I can earn money to support myself. When you're dancing live, some people will contact you.
She then uses another platform to share sexual content or arrange physical meetings. She says the man who recruited her takes a cut of everything she earns and pressured her to have sex with him.
I told him I was 15 years old. He said it is okay, and he loves young girls below 18, and he gives them work.
Charities say they are seeing more cases of child sexual exploitation through live streaming. Dr. Issa Kapera is acting country director for Child Fund Kenya.
It's both people, both locals and foreigners, target these young girls. And these young girls also, because of poverty, they're driven to look for money from people who offer them sexual, whatever, we call it sextortion.
TikTok's guidelines ban the selling of sexual services, and users need to be 18 in order to live stream and receive gifts. TikTok outsources its content moderation to another company called Teleperformance. One of their content moderators agreed to speak as long as we disguised his identity.
TikTok actually knows what's happening in Kenya, but they're not doing anything to solve it. It's all about business. Live content that is sexual in nature tend to appear at night. I think they've started to cover nighttime, but moderation should never stop. There's also inefficiency of the artificial intelligence. The AI is not enough to select content which is pornographic or soliciting sex.
A spokesperson for TikTok said in a statement that they have zero tolerance for exploitation and they enforce strict safety policies, including robust live content rules and moderation in 70 languages, including Swahili.
Dabula Kamoli reporting there, and you can hear her full investigation by searching BBC The Documentary online or wherever you usually get your podcasts. Welcome back to NewsHour. Pakistan is pressing ahead with the deportation of Afghans, despite warnings from the UN that some who fled across the border are in need of international protection. More than 900 people were sent back in the first half of February, double the number who were deported in the 2 weeks before then. Well, Pakistan says it's targeting illegal foreign nationals. BBC News has spoken to families in hiding. Their names and identities have been withheld for safety. Our correspondent in Pakistan, Azadeh Mashiri, sent us this report from Islamabad.
Ahmad walks us through his neighbourhood. Many of the homes he shows us seem empty. He and his family have chosen to stay, but hide when they hear the police is nearby. He says he used to work for a Western charity in Afghanistan and was in the final stages of a US resettlement program. 2 weeks ago, when he was out shopping, he received a call. It was his daughter's voice on the line.
My baby, 3 years, called me, "Come, Baba, here is the police." Yeah, police came to our homes.
Ahmad had his visa extended, but his wife was still waiting for hers. The police said they'd have to take her and his child to Haji camp, where many Afghans in Islamabad and Rawalpindi are being held. He decided to go with them. He shows me a video similar to ones other Afghans have sent me. In it, men, women and children are being driven away.
The situation was unimaginable and was very bad, particularly for women and children. Poor family only one blanket, and also they collect the phone of everyone, and our communication cut with outside.
Ahmad's family was released 3 days later.
We've come here to Haji camp to try to verify some of the accounts we're hearing, but officials and the police here won't let us in. The Pakistani government does insist that no one is mistreated during the repatriation process. There are also some Afghans around us, some people who have come here to search for their relatives who they say are being held in the camp.
Pakistan has taken in millions of Afghans over more than 40 years. The UN says there are about 3 million in the country today. But Pakistan is frustrated by what it calls very slow resettlement programs in other countries and says this problem can't go on forever. Families like Nabila's are terrified of what that could mean for them. At 10 years old, her life is limited to the confines of her home in Islamabad and the dirt road outside it. Her father Hamid served in the Afghan military. They believe he and their family will be punished or killed if they return.
Don't force us out. Don't kick Afghans out of their homes. We are not here by choice.
The Taliban government has told the BBC all Afghans can live in the country without any fear. But the UN has previously cast doubt on an amnesty. Pakistan says its policies are aimed at all illegal foreign nationals. But Afghans we've spoken to feel their lives are hanging by a thread and their time in Pakistan running out.
Azadeh Mashiri reporting from Islamabad there. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Regini Vaidyanathan. Well, now let's bring you a developing story and a major police operation's underway in the German city of Mannheim after a vehicle drove into a crowd of people. Well, local police have confirmed that a suspect has been arrested. Well, Danny Eberhard is the BBC's Europe regional editor and joins us now live. A moving story, of course, Danny, but bring us up to date.
So what we know so far, Regina, is that about 12:15 local time, a car was driven into a group of people. That's happened in the very centre of Magdeburg near Paradeplatz, the centre
of Mannheim.
Mannheim. And the according to police, they haven't actually said who they have arrested. They said they have arrested a suspect, but they also haven't speculated about whether this was an accident or an attack or some other sort of incident. And they've certainly not mentioned anything about it being a terror attack at this stage, although lots of people would have that in mind for this sort of incident. They've said that at least one person has died. They've also said that several people have been badly injured. They haven't said how badly injured nor how many people. Some reports in the German press suggest that maybe two people have died and 25 people have been injured, but that hasn't been confirmed officially. And there's a big security operation obviously in place, so the area has been cordoned off. Residents are being warned to stay away from the city centre, or if they're in the city centre, to stay at home.
What more have we heard from eyewitnesses? And we've seen some images of the aftermath of the scene circulating as well, haven't we?
So the car was apparently driven at speed, and the Mannheim at the moment, it's carnival time in Germany at the moment, so it's celebrating today Rose Monday, Pink Monday. It's an important day in the carnival calendar, and some of the area there there's food stalls and fairground rides. German cities for things like Christmas, Easter, carnival celebrate these with markets, and obviously there are real worries about how to provide security for people in these sort of events. So we have seen in the past, for example, an attack at the Christmas market in Magdeburg in December. Six people were killed in that and 300 people were injured. But this one, they haven't yet said, was necessarily a terrorist attack, nor do we know where the person who has apparently carried it out, where that person is from.
Yeah, and indeed, it was only a few weeks ago as well that we were discussing the attack in Munich as well, which authorities did say was a terror-related attack. Of course, all of this coming, well, there's a lot of political change in Germany as well. So just briefly, set that into context.
So basically, on the 23rd of February, Germany had its federal elections, and the two big issues to dominate the campaign were immigration and the issue of security in that context, and the economy. So there is fears in Germany about public safety, for example. They've linked it to immigration, although, as I say, there is no link currently that this incident is linked to immigration in any way. So we'll have to wait to see for further police updates on that.
Indeed, Danny Eberhard, thank you very much. And this is, of course, a developing story, and there's more on the BBC News website on that as well. Now let's turn to another story that we are watching closely. And the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza is looking ever more uncertain as Israel continues to block all humanitarian aid into the territory. Well, Israel's accused Hamas of stealing supplies and using them to finance its activities. Hamas says the blockade is cheap blackmail. The United Nations says the suspension of aid is a violation of international law and has called for that truce to hold. What does this mean for people on the ground in Gaza? Well, Bilal Al-Halou says food prices have already risen in Gaza City.
There is a lot of fear. Today, there are a lot of people buying food supplies and prices have risen a lot. The longer the crossing remains closed, the prices will rise and increase even more. Today, a kilo of sugar costs 10 shekels, about $2.78, or 12 shekels, $3.33. Prices are rising and people are panicking about food supplies.
Well, Rosalia Bollin is a UNICEF spokesperson and she's in Rafah in the south of Gaza, one of the main crossings for aid to enter. She began first by telling me about UNICEF's work there.
We've been going to these crossings every morning to collect goods and to bring them into Gaza because trucks are not allowed to drive straight into Gaza. So trucks would arrive on the Israeli side. They would offload goods there, and then we would come with Palestinian trucks, with our UNICEF trucks, to pick those goods up and then bring them to the warehouses for onward distribution to families. But that has now completely halted, so there is no collection anymore. At the moment, we have some items left that we had collected previously, but because the needs in Gaza are just staggering, we have been trying to distribute the items that we've been bringing in as soon as we could. So we've been handing them out to families, to the most vulnerable children and families in Gaza as soon as possible.
The ceasefire that we saw, the first phase of it in recent weeks, how much of a difference has that made then in terms of getting supplies in, and what sort of supplies have you been getting in?
If we look just purely in terms of the volume of goods that, for instance, UNICEF has been able to bring in, if we compare the 6 weeks before the ceasefire and the 6 weeks after the ceasefire, we see a threefold increase in terms of the items that UNICEF has been able to bring in. Those items are very broad. So for UNICEF, it's things like medical disposables, specialized medical equipment for hospitals, especially for neonatal units, vaccines, not just polio vaccines, but also for routine immunization, nutrition supplements, sanitary pads, intimate wash gel for women and adolescent girls. And in the context of Gaza, they are life-saving. This is a population that has had hardly anything for over 50 months. That's a long period.
And also about shelter, because that's been one of the greatest needs.
This is the real reason why this stoppage in aid is going to be devastating. The extent of destruction in Gaza is really unbelievable. It's chilling when you drive through Gaza. Some areas are more affected than others. For instance, in Rafah, in Khan Yunis, Jabalia, there's hardly any buildings still standing. The buildings that are still standing look like they're about to collapse. people who have been displaced, and the vast majority of the population has been displaced, they have no homes to return to. Many families nevertheless have. They have put up makeshift tents on top of the rubble, and so they are in improvised tents. I can't even call them tents because they're made up of whatever people can get their hands of. UNICEF has been distributing 300,000 tarpaulins, so that is used as well by families, but people aren't protected from the elements. They're in a dangerous environment. They're in buildings that are about to collapse. There is contamination of unexploded ordnance. They're deprived of electricity. Yesterday, I met a girl whose arm was broken. And when I asked what had happened, she said that she'd gone back to her old home in Rafah, which is somewhat intact, but there is no light at night anywhere in Gaza. And she has fallen down the stairs in the dark and broken her arm. There's contaminated water, there's open sewage. It's just dirty and dangerous for kids to be in.
And it's all happening right now during Ramadan. So what's the mood there, given that this is normally a time, of course, of celebration?
Yesterday, as I was walking around a tent camp, I was quite struck by a group of young girls. I think they were probably 7, 8 years old, stopping me. They saw the UNICEF logo, the UN logo. And so they started to ask questions about the ceasefire, about assistance. They asked me, is the war going to restart? They have a handicapped sister who needs a wheelchair. They still live in a tent. The tent is leaking. Why aren't we bringing more to them? They want to go back to school. They need notebooks. So those are what children ask me. Parents are worried. They're deeply worried about what the future might hold.
That's Rosalia Bollen from UNICEF speaking to us from Rafah in southern Gaza. It's that time of year when Hollywood rolls out the finest red carpet at the Dolby Theatre for the Oscars. Well, this year's ceremony came in the aftermath of devastating wildfires in the Los Angeles area. So, as well as the usual parade of celebrities, some of the city's firefighters were also honoured on stage, receiving a standing ovation. The show must go on, as our Los Angeles correspondent Emma Vardy reports.
It's the Oscars, and I say, let's do this thing. You ready to go? I am.
A Wizard of Oz-themed opening from the stars of Wicked got the show underway. The film won 2 awards for both production design and costume design.
And the Oscar goes to...
Oh, Anora.
But taking 5 of the 6 awards it was nominated for was Anora, an independent film about a prostitute who marries a rich Russian playboy.
What is that? Is that a butterfly?
Yeah, it's a butterfly.
You're so classy.
I know.
I got dollar signs like a real hoe.
Anora. Sean Baker!
Its creator, Sean Baker, made history, winning 4 Oscars on one movie, taking Best Picture, Director, Editing and Screenplay. In one of his acceptance speeches, he urged the public to see movies on the big screen.
Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Parents, introduce your children to feature films in movie theaters, and you'll be molding the next generation of movie lovers and filmmakers.
Mikey Madison.
Star of Anora, Mikey Madison, was named Best Actress for her portrayal of a feisty sex worker.
I also just want to again recognize and honor the sex worker community. I will continue to support and be an ally.
Yes. Tell me, why is an accomplished foreign architect shoveling coal here in Philadelphia?
I'm afraid it is not so simple.
22 years after his first Oscar win in The Pianist, Adrian Brody picked up another Best Actor award for his role as a Holocaust survivor remaking his life in America in the 3.5-hour epic The Brutalist. He then gave a more than 5-minute-long acceptance speech.
Okay, I'll get out of here. I love you. I appreciate you all.
Emilia Perez had been a frontrunner until controversy over its star actor's social media posts. But Zoe Saldana did win Best Supporting Actress and highlighted her heritage.
I am a proud child of immigrant parents. With dreams and dignity. and hardworking hands, and I am the first American of Dominican origin to accept an Academy Award, and I know I will not be the last.
The Pope is dead.
The British screenwriter Peter Strawn accepted the award for Best Adapted Screenplay for Conclave.
I'm here with my daughter, Connie. Connie, I love you. This is for you. That's not the same as yours. It's not like that jumper that you keep taking, okay? This is mine. Thank you so much.
The only prize for the papal thriller, which had 8 nominations.
Emma Vardy reporting there. This is Regina Vaidyanathan with NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC in London. The Nigerian-born, US-based author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie has been listed as one of Time magazine's 100 most influential people. Her essay, We Should All Be Feminists, was sampled by Beyoncé and copied onto T-shirts. And over the years, of course, she's written novels, poetry and numerous short stories. But her new book, Dream Count, is a return to fiction after more than a decade away. So, why the long wait? Well, she spoke to the BBC's Emma Barnett.
I couldn't write for a while, and then I started writing again.
What was it, do you think? What was the block?
I don't know, and I think it comes with creativity. This is what I tell myself to feel better. That sometimes when you want to create, you don't, and that maybe this is a good thing because maybe it shouldn't be easy. Mm. Right? Maybe creativity should come with difficulties to somehow make it deeper. This is all to cheer myself up. But I can tell you that when I could not write, it was terrifying. And it felt like being shut out from myself. And it's a really frightening place to be. Because writing is the thing that gives me meaning. Writing fiction, I should say.
Right.
And so when I couldn't, I wanted to write fiction and I couldn't. And I just really felt terror. I felt terror. I thought, what if I never write again?
And at the same time, in this period, you become a mother.
I did.
3 times over, I should say. There was a daughter, there is a wonderful daughter, and now twin boys, 11 months old.
Yes.
That does something to you, of course, as well.
It does. Actually, my block, and I don't like to use that expression because I'm too superstitious.
Okay.
But my something that happened that I couldn't...
The space.
Yes, the space. That's good. Happened when I became pregnant. Something just changed. And I'm not sure that it was just entirely physiological, but something changed. And I just could not get back into that sort of magical place where I can write fiction. I have always longed to be known, truly known by another human being. Sometimes we live for years with yearnings that we cannot name, until a crack appears in the sky and widens and reveals us to ourselves.
Dream Count tells a story of 4 women's lives interconnected, and you go into great detail about their stories and then some of those themes. But just to stay with this for a moment, it's also very visceral at times about women's health. Why did you make that choice? What are you doing there?
Well, I'm telling a story, but I think a number of things. I've always felt that when one writes fiction, realistic fiction as I do, that there is a kind of, there's a responsibility to honesty, to what I call a kind of radical honesty. Like we have to tell the truth. And it's interesting how little of literature is about women and women's bodies, women's sort of physicality. I mean, we all came from a woman. We all come from a woman's body. And that isn't really a thing that is explored very deeply in literature. And I hope that will change. So I felt it was important to do that we not to talk about childbirth as this sort of gauzy thing, that the next thing we see, the woman has the baby wrapped in white and she's gazing adoringly at the baby, that there's a lot that is, you know, almost animalistic about birthing a child. I think the greatest gift that I've had as a person in the world is to be a mother. But I also think it's important that literature, you know, engage with it in a way that's visceral and true and possibly uncomfortable.
You are now also the mother of sons, as we've said.
I am indeed.
And looking back at what you've said about feminism, and how are you going to avoid that cage of masculinity that you talked about?
Well, I'm determined to raise good men. And fortunately, they also have a good man for a father. That helps. I think I want to raise my boys to be in touch with emotion, to not be afraid of emotion, and also to not be afraid of fear. I think often we raise men to think that fear is this kind of thing that one must pretend not to feel. And to make them the kind of boys that never start a fight, but if you bring a fight to them, they will beat you up. That's kind of that's my game plan.
That's the plan at the moment. I mean, they're 11 months old, so it's quite a way to go. In 2014, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie published an essay of her popular TED talk that was her take on feminism that was then sampled by Beyoncé.
Feminist, a person who believes in the social, political and economic equality of the sexes.
Where are we with feminism now, do you think?
We should say that there is no place in the world where women are equal. There are places that are better and places that are worse, but there is just gender equality does not exist yet. I think that what's happened in places like the US has been surprising, because I did not think that we would be talking about women's reproductive rights in 2025, but we are. I think our bodies are the only things that we have that actually are ours when you really think about it. And I actually understand people who oppose abortion. I understand that position. I even respect that position, but it's a position you cannot impose on everyone. And to do that in policy, in law, just feels to me a way of saying that you do not recognize a woman's full humanity. Because if I cannot do something, this is all I have, this body. And if I can't do with it what I want, then you're really saying that I'm not fully human or fully a citizen. And I'm surprised that that's happening in the US. But I also think that I don't think it will last. You know, I don't think it will.
I mean, that's an aspect of it. We're also in a world, I'm thinking again, what's changed in, you know, the last more than decade since you brought your last novel out. The Me Too movement's happened, but also the rise and rise and rise of social media.
Mm.
And how women themselves view themselves, augment themselves. What do you think the impact has been on the road to gender equality because of social media?
Mm. Actually, what worries me the most about social media is the impact on young people. It also rewires our brains.
Mm.
It changes us.
Yes.
And I would like for something more noble to change us.
And then there's AI.
I remember reading a piece about AI writing a short story. And I thought, that's not a short story. We shouldn't even call it a short story. Human creativity and the human imagination, we should never think that we can somehow replace. As a writer, I care so much about the human imagination, about creativity, about our ability to tell stories. Just imagine our lives without storytelling. I mean, it would be bleak. We should be able to look into the future and say, in 50 years, what's the world supposed to be? And what do we want the world to be? Because that's also important.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie speaking to the BBC's Emma Barnett. That's it for this edition of NewsHour. I'm Regina Vaidyanathan. Thanks for listening.